I'm a happy recovered alcoholic named Paul. And I love you too, and there's absolutely nothing that you can do about it. The late, great Ed Mutum used to say that the word enthusiasm has a root word, a Greek root word, and that is entheos. And that means the God from within. And I thank you today for showing me your God from within. Give yourselves a round of applause. It's an honor and a privilege to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, especially to introduce an amazing human being that I have come to love and know quite well. Deb, speak up. I met Deb when I asked her to come speak at the South Carolina Young People's about 4 years ago. Essie in the house, I see that. Because I heard her CD and it was a powerful message. And over the 4 years, I've got to know her very well. And she has walked with me through some amazingly difficult times. She's one of those members of Alcoholics Anonymous that doesn't just talk this program, that she lives it in her life. And she is a shining example of the power of God and what He can take you through. The best compliment that I can pay her is that I have an 18-year-old daughter, and if she ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous to save her life, Deb is the person that I would send her to. You are going to hear an amazing story, and it's going to touch your heart like it's going to touch mine, and I won't take up any more of her time. Deb.
My name's Deb. I'm a real alcoholic. Thank you. Thank you. It is really good to be in Atlanta, Georgia. It's really good to be at an IKIPA. I've never been to one before. So the bar has been set pretty high. I'd like to thank Matt for calling to ask me to come and speak. And, you know, I didn't know that I was going to need to be here this weekend when he called me so many months ago to ask me to come. But there's no place that I need to be more than be here right now. Thank you for having me. I'm going to do my best to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I don't know what that's going to look like. I don't know what that's going to sound like tonight. You know, before I get up behind a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, I pray. And I pray because I have a message to deliver to you tonight, a message of hope and a message of a life restored and a message of a successful life that I wouldn't have had if I didn't have a loving God active in my life every single moment that I breathe. And so I go to him in prayer, and I said, you know what, it's just you and me. Your message, my voice, let's get it done. And so my hope in standing up here tonight is that the message that God's given me and my delivery of that message is going to help someone else in this room choose to be sober today rather than go out and drink tonight. So let's get this party started. My sobriety date is March 15th, 1987. I walked into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 15 years old. I was absolutely certain my life was over. My cool card had been pulled, and I was never going to have fun again. Certain of it. I was born and raised in a little town right outside of Akron, Ohio. And in that little town, we had about 5,000, 6,000 permanent residents, and all of the families in that, well, most of the families in that town had moved into Ohio from West Virginia after the coal mines had shut down. And so we were, you know, poor working class folks who were just kind of putting it together day by day. And my family was no different than that. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My father worked, he was a union man, he worked in a factory down the road, and he went to work every single day. He drank every single day, and that's just the truth about the home that I grew up in. And my mom, she was skilled labor. She worked at another factory down the road. She wasn't union, so she made less money. And you know, they were just putting it together. And, you know, what my life was like growing up in that home is real basic for alcoholism. I was walking around every single day, and I had my hands balled up in fists like this. I was so incredibly scared. But it was not okay to be scared. It was easier to be angry, and it was safer to be angry. And so I walked around with my hands balled up in fists, waiting for somebody to take me up on that fight I was trying to pick. And I was just ready. I was ready all the time. I didn't know that I was angry. I didn't know that I was hurt. I didn't know that I was scared. All I knew was that things were crazy. I felt crazy, and I was so incredibly unhappy. I was terrified every day. You know, there's that sound that tires make when they roll down a gravel road or roll down a gravel driveway. We had a long gravel driveway that came to my house. And when I hear that sound, even today, it makes me sit up and take notice, because my father was a violent alcoholic. And when he would come home from work and his tires would roll down that gravel driveway real slow, I was automatically terrified because I didn't know what the night was going to look like. I didn't know if it was going to be the night where he drank the 12-pack, passed out early, or if it was going to be the night where he drank the 12-pack, went back and got another 6-pack, came back home, and all hell was going to break loose. I didn't know what that was going to look like. And I was ready all the time, because I had to be. And I ran out of hiding places, and that's just the way it was for me. And so I walked around with my hands balled up in fists, and I was ready to fight. And when I was 9 years old, all I had been told about alcohol, because I kept wondering what this stuff was. It was so incredibly important in my house. You know, it was important to my dad that he drink a lot of it. It was important to my mom that he not drink a lot of it. And so they were constantly fighting with each other. And when I would ask questions about what is that stuff, all I was told is that's for adults and you don't need to know anything. Well, you know, if I ask you a question even today, please tell me the answer. Because if you don't, I'm going to go figure it out. And that's not always going to look good. But I'm going to go figure it out. And so when I was 9 years old, I went to figure it out. You know, I had a friend, and her parents had a full bar in their basement, and we were having a conversation, and her parents drank, but they weren't mean. But they drank a lot, and they partied just as hard as my dad did. And I said, you know, I'm coming to spend the night, and we should sleep in the bar, and we should try some of this drinking stuff. And she thought that was a grand idea. And so we went down, and it was a night of firsts for me. It was my first drink, my first drunk, my first blackout, my first hangover the next day. I mean, I hit the ground running. We picked bottles off the bar based on their labels. And if it had a good-looking label, we picked it up, and we took the top off, and we took a drink to see if we could get it down or not. I mean, it was that simple. The first bottle I picked was Christian Brothers. It's brandy. I thought it was whiskey. It's brandy. It had little pilgrims on the label. At 9 years old, I picked the pilgrims. And I can tell you, it took many, many, many of those bottles on that bar in order to get enough alcohol into my system in order for me to realize what this stuff was. I didn't know it was magic. I didn't. Because, you know, nobody treated it like magic in my house. You know, my dad treated it like an entitlement, and my mom treated it like evil. I didn't know it was magic. And, you know, once that magic hit, I mean, it hit, and I remember it today. You know, I got this warm, safe, fuzzy feeling. And for the first time in my 9 years of life, my hands let loose. And my shoulders came off of my ears. And I exhaled. And I felt okay. And I thought, if my mom would just drink some of this stuff, everybody would get along so much better. I mean, seriously, I got it. You know, I understood why my dad drank. And maybe he got mean because my mom didn't drink with him. You know, and if she needed a drink, she did. I mean, if it would do for her what it did for me, she needed a drink. And I made a decision the next day. I mean, I was so incredibly sick. Oh, how I was sick. And I was also a little bit worried because my friend was telling me about some things that I had done that I didn't really remember. I don't know if that was a full blackout. It likely was. And so I was a little bit worried, and I was real sick and not feeling great. But, you know, it was amazing that my mind automatically dismissed all of that and said, but do you remember how you felt? Do you remember how good that was? And I was like, yeah, I do. And I made a decision that day. I was going to drink as much of this stuff as often as I could, period. I didn't think about consequences. I didn't think about how I was going to get it. I didn't think about how sick I was going to get. I didn't know any of that. All I knew was that when I had alcohol in my system, everything felt better. I didn't know I had a problem and needed a solution. But I knew that I found a solution to whatever ailed me that night. And I was going to drink this stuff as often as I could. So anyway, I finished elementary school with, you know, very few consequences. You know, it's tough, you know, drinking as young as we drink. We know this. This is a room of my people. But it's tough when you drink as young. You can't just go through the beverage drive-thru on your Huffy, you know, put some beer in the basket on the front of the bicycle, you know, pedal home and kick back and watch Scooby-Doo and have some cold beers. You know, it's a little more challenging than that. We got to work a little harder. We have to lie a little bit more often. You know, we really got to get started on this really sneaky way of life, and we got to do it really well. And so I started working at it because I knew that it was worth it. I was okay with working for anything that was worth it. I mean, I built a fort in my backyard that was enormous and had multiple rooms because I needed a place to hide, and so the work was worth it. So I was willing to go to whatever lengths to get the alcohol that I needed because I needed that relief. I needed to be able to drink. I needed for my shoulders to come off my ears, and I needed to be able to feel safe. And the funny thing is, I was no safer when I was drunk than when I was sober, but my mind told me that I was. My mind told me that I could go anywhere I wanted and do anything that it took, and I would be okay. And that was one of the big lies. That was one of the big lies. Anyway, my drinking career didn't last long. Obviously, I got sober at 15, started at 9, so I was out there for about 6 years. And what I can tell you is the last year of my drinking, most of it I don't remember. I remember bits and pieces, but to put it together in one straight line, I just can't do most of it. What I can tell you is that the last 6 to 9 months, it's a little bit of a crapshoot, I was completely unable to draw a sober breath. And I wasn't unable to draw a sober breath because I was choosing to drink every single day or every time I was sober. I was unable to draw a sober breath because I was physically addicted to alcohol. When I sobered up in the morning, it was painful. I couldn't make it to lunch without shaking apart. I absolutely had withdrawal that I could not take. And so I had to drink. And so drawing a sober breath was no longer an option for me. And what else was going on in my life was real simple. I was living two different lives. During the day, I was getting straight A's. I was playing 3 varsity sports. I was president of my class. I was the girl that every mom wanted her son to date. I ran everything because that's what we do when we're like this. We run everything. And so I ran everything at my school. But what I was doing that last couple of months of my drinking is that I was drinking on the way to school because I couldn't make it till lunch. I was drinking before I played volleyball games at night. I play one volleyball game I don't remember at all. I had great stats. But I don't remember it. I had a conversation about that with my volleyball coach, and he said, "You honestly don't remember that?" And I said, "I have no idea. I have no idea." So I was doing that stuff, and I was drinking, and I was drinking every single day. And you know, the more I drank and the more alcohol I required, the seedier my friends had to get. I had to find people who thought that it was okay to buy a 14 and a 15-year-old her own fifth of vodka on a daily basis. I had to find those people who lived in the dark houses on the wrong side of the tracks so that I could just walk in every single night whenever I could wiggle free and go pick up that bottle, take the lid off, throw it away, put my back against the wall and slide down and pray to God that I was invisible that night. Those are the kinds of places that I had to go day in and day out. Those are the kind of people that I hung out with. And I can tell you that the things that happened to me in that house during some of those nights, I am so grateful that I was a blackout drinker. I'm so grateful I was a blackout drinker because I remember enough. And part of getting sober and part of why getting sober is so incredibly painful is because I didn't know what to do with that stuff that was going on in my head. You know, that stuff doesn't disappear when we stop drinking. And for many of us, it's the reason why we don't choose to stop drinking when we're given the opportunity to be a member of this fellowship and to work this program and put a life together. Because the thought of getting through all that stuff is just overwhelming. And it was overwhelming for me. I had absolutely no skills. I didn't know what to do with that stuff. I didn't know how to make it stop. I didn't know how to drink the way I needed to drink without going to those places and being with those people and putting myself in harm's way. I didn't know how to make that happen. And when I was sober, I just couldn't do it. I absolutely couldn't do it. The shame, the guilt, the remorse was so incredibly overwhelming. You know, I know what it's like today to be in so much pain that I can't breathe. And today it's the second time in my life that I've been in that spot. What happened to me was a gift. I had a wild miscalculation one night. Usually I was pretty good about where I was going to go and who I was going to be with and what kind of story I was going to tell, who to keep it all straight. I controlled things. That's what I did. And so I was able to drink the way I needed to drink for a long time and make sure that all of the pieces stayed in place and all the players were happy. And I would have to do things like, you know, shimmy down the side of the house with bed sheets tied together to sneak out because I was only able to drink half my bottle and there was another half waiting on me and you're going to go back. I mean, you don't not go back. I really went to any lengths to drink. And my mom and my dad, they finally got a divorce. When I was 12 and my sister was 14, we took my mom to the side and we were like, look, you got to get us out of here. We can't leave without you. We're too young. So it's up to you. We can't take the beatings anymore. We just can't take it. We don't want to take it. We don't want to watch him treat you the way he treats you. And, you know, we don't want to be in that line anymore. And so we talked my mom into leaving my dad, and they had the longest divorce case in our county's history because my dad, being the good alcoholic that he was, you know, nobody was going to leave him. And he was going to fight it to death. Even though all my life, all he ever said, well, if it wasn't for that, you know, GD wife of mine and those GD kids, everything would be so much better. You know, so he didn't want us. He didn't have any room in his life for us because alcohol took up all of that space. But he made it very, very hard on us to leave. And what that did for my family is that it put us, when we left, we went into abject poverty. I had no idea. You know, kids don't really understand necessarily who makes the money and how all that gets spent and what goes to rent and what goes to food and all those kinds of things. We just don't get that. And when I'm 12 years old, all I wanted was freedom from the terror. And so we left. And my mom had to get two extra jobs in order to keep the roof over our head and to keep food in the refrigerator. And so she got really, really busy trying to make life work. And she understood what she was walking into when she left. That's why she stayed so long. Because she understood what that was going to mean. We didn't get it. And once that happened, and we're watching her work two jobs, and I'm 12, and I can't do much about it, but I can drink. And so I'm drinking, and she's working, and my sister's doing drugs, and my mom's working, and everything is absolutely off the chain crazy. But we're making it slowly. Very, very slowly. And it kept my mom so incredibly busy that as long as I was getting A's and as long as I was playing the sports and as long as I was, you know, president of my class or president of the student council or whatever it was I had to be, as long as I was doing those things, she just assumed that I was okay because she didn't have any room in her life for one more thing to not be okay. And so my sister was doing drugs and she was off the chain and I was drinking and I was off the chain and nobody was really keeping watch over us because she just didn't have room to do it. And so when I was 15 years old, I had been, you know, like I said, drinking absolutely around the clock for 6 to 9 months. It was fall of the year, and my mom went out of town for a weekend, and I was supposed to go somewhere, and my sister was supposed to go somewhere and spend the night with proper supervision and all that kind of stuff. And I had the great idea that if we just invited those people from the wrong side of the tracks over to our house for the night, that somehow it would work out better for us. Somehow it would be more safe. Somehow those things wouldn't happen. And so we called them and we told them to come and to bring our stuff to us because we wouldn't be crossing the tracks that night. They could come over. And we had an outlandish party. It was something that I'd never planned on. I really believed that it would be different if we just changed the location of things. And what I can tell you about that night is I started drinking around 7. They brought me Jack Daniels instead of vodka. I drank the, and one of them walked in and said, "I don't know why we brought her that whole bottle. She can't drink that much." Well, really. So I started drinking at 7. The bottle was empty by 9. I was in an alcohol stupor. I was curled up in a fetal position in the corner of my couch, and I was absolutely physically unable to move. My mom walked in at 1:16 a.m. She had had a fight with the boyfriend that she'd gone out of town with, and so she had decided to come home, and she walked back into her house, which was completely trashed, full of people. You guys know the scene. It was very ugly. And I hadn't moved since 9. So her baby daughter, who was straight A's and class president and all of these things, was sitting there in all of her own bodily fluids. And it was a really, really bad deal. And somehow there was a list of all of the people that had been at the party, all of the adults who had provided all of the drugs and alcohol, and all of the minors that had been in attendance. And that, I don't know how that list got generated, but it got generated. And everybody in town got real angry because it's a small town. And there were warrants going out for people's arrests, and it was just getting really ugly. And so I decided that I needed to get out of town. Now, I don't have a license or a job or any money or any real way to get out of town, but the big treatment craze to put adolescents into treatment had just started. And so I was thinking, well, I just got busted having this party. Clearly I was intoxicated and I can't get out of that one. So maybe I'll play this treatment card and they'll put me in treatment out of town somewhere and I can get out of Dodge and let all the dust settle. And then I can come back and everything's going to be okay again. And so I played that treatment card. Everybody bought it. They went for the head fake and off I go to treatment 2 weeks later. Now I needed to go to treatment 2 weeks later. I couldn't go that day because I had affairs to get in order. Now, I don't know what affairs a 15-year-old has to get in order, but I had some affairs I needed to get in order. And so we put it off. And my mom, you know, she wanted us to be home for a Thanksgiving and whatever. So on, you know, the Saturday after Thanksgiving in 1986, I'm headed to treatment. It really didn't occur to me that they were going to lock the doors at that treatment center in downtown Cleveland and that I wasn't going to be able to shimmy out my window down bed sheets and go get something to drink. It just never really occurred to me that they were going to have a little closer eye on me. And it never occurred to me that I wasn't, that they were going to cut off my access to alcohol. You know, it just, and the thought of going through an entire day without anything to drink was just wholly unacceptable to me. It just, I didn't know how I was going to do that. And there was a guy in my town who had been to treatment. He was like, "They're not going to let you drink. They locked that door." And I was like, no. It'll be fine. I can sneak out. And he said, "Trust me. You're not getting out." And I'm like, "Well, that's just not an option." And he said, "Well, I'm sorry, but it's the way it's going to be." And so, you know, processing all that information with the mind that I had at the age that I was, I thought that committing suicide was probably a better option than going to treatment and not being able to drink. You know, I mean, I only had two options. Getting sober certainly wasn't one. So I decided I was going to go ahead and try to commit suicide because, you know, the whole idea of being sober with the head and with the stuff that was going on in my head, I didn't want any part of it anyway. I just really wasn't that interested. And I absolutely hated who I'd become. I hated how I felt. I hated how I saw the world. It just wasn't what I wanted. And so I spent 2 days trying to drink myself to death. I went to those friends on the wrong side of the tracks, and I let them know that I was going to treatment, and it was in everybody's best interest if that didn't happen, because the truth would come out. And so they put together a little concoction, a little baggie of pills for me. And they said, you know, take the yellow ones and then the white ones and the pink ones and, you know, do this deal. Because I told them, I said, you know, I want to drink enough that I don't wake up. But my issue was that I could drink a lot of alcohol and then I would pass out. And I said, so if we can come up with some kind of concoction that'll keep me from passing out, I can just drink myself to death and this will all be over. And so they put together a little concoction of pills for me to try. And I, you know, I got drunk and then I got confused and I just took them all at the same time. And it didn't work. And I came to in downtown Cleveland in Glen Bay Hospital, which at that time was an inpatient adolescent treatment facility. I came to on Monday. I checked in there on Saturday. and I came to on Monday. And you know, in that hospital, they didn't believe that adolescents could be real alcoholics. They didn't believe in detoxing us. So they just put me in a room with everything bolted down and let me shake, rattle, and roll for as long as it took. And I was incredibly sick. I'd been drinking the clock round for months. And they didn't detox me. I came to on Monday, and while I was in that treatment center, I had created my alcohol and drug use inventory. Now, when I concocted this plan to go away to treatment, I wasn't going to tell anybody how much I was drinking. I was going to tell them a little bit about how much I was drinking, just enough to qualify to be there for the 10-day evaluation period, but not long enough, that they would keep me for treatment. And so I got honest with them when I was in this blackout, and they decided that they were going to keep me for the full 40 days of treatment. And I had finished the first 10 days. I went downstairs to the treatment unit. And as soon as I got downstairs, they called a code, and all of the counselors were rolling up their sleeves and loosening their ties, and they're headed for the stairs to go up to the unit where I had just come from. And I stopped. I said, "What's going on?" And they said, "Your sister's here." Not only did I get honest about my own drinking, but I got honest about how much she was using at the same time. So they called my ma at home, and they said, "You've got another one. As soon as this one finishes her 10 days, bring us the other one." And so my sister landed. And so after her 10 days, I wondered if they were going to keep her. Well, they decided to keep her too. And so she came downstairs, and I was so excited to see her because we were partners in crime. And I ran up, and I'm like, "Oh, I'm so happy to see you." And she looked at me, and she said, "Don't go to sleep. It's your fault that I'm here. Don't go to sleep." And I was like, "Oh, okay." And they thought it was a grand idea. They had one room at the end of the hall that had a bathroom that adjoined the two bedrooms. They figured since we were sisters, they could stick us in there and we'd be okay. So I spent the last 20 days of treatment wide awake. Wide awake with my sister doing this kind of stuff. You know, I'd be sitting in group therapy and she'd walk by the door and just glare at me. I got out of treatment. I'm headed to the stairs to get on the elevator to go down, and she saw 10 days of treatment left, and she came up and she said, "You don't relapse until I get out of here. Am I clear?" I said, "Yes." And she said, "Okay." She said, "Here's the deal. You go get your stuff, you go get my stuff, and you hide it and you wait. You don't get to be out there drinking while I'm in this place because it's your fault I'm here." And I said, "Oh, okay." So I went home and I got my bottle and I got her some drugs of various kinds. I wasn't real sure what she wanted, so I just went and got her a little smattering of everything. Put them under the floorboard in the upstairs because that's where we kept things. And, I drank and she did drugs. That way there was no conflict of interest in our house. And so she gets out of treatment and I'm so excited because I've been sober on the outside for 10 years. Days. Okay, and while I was in treatment, we didn't deal with what was going on in my head. We didn't deal with what I thought, what I felt, what I believed to be true with the memories. We didn't deal with any of that stuff. I did everything that I could to learn as little as possible. I really did because I had absolutely no intention of being sober when I got out. And so I'm sober for 10 days on the outside waiting for her to come home for treatment so that we can get this thing started again because my head is screaming. Now, you might be thinking, why did you wait the 10 days? And I really have no idea other than she told me to. And she's my older sister. And so I waited. And she came home and I was like, "Come upstairs." And I showed her everything that I'd gotten and I was so excited. And I'm like, "Tonight, as soon as Mom goes to bed, it's on." And she said, "Well, I had what they called a spiritual experience." And I was like, "No, uh-uh. There'll be no spiritual experiences. No." She said, "Well, they said I should go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I think we ought to try to be clean and sober." And I said, "You don't even drink." And she said, "They said NA sucks. I got to go to AA." I said, "I don't get it, and I don't want to go to AA." And she said, "I don't care. We're going to AA. If you don't go, I'll tell." So So off we go to AA. You know, my mom, she drives us there. She drops us off 15 minutes before the meeting. I didn't smoke, but we got out there. We bummed cigarettes. You know, we stayed outside. We smoked them. I choked them down. She smoked them. And, you know, and we smoked until we were late for the meeting. And then we would go into the meeting. We would be as loud as we could because it was all about us. We would take our chairs and we would screech them across the floor when we pulled them out from the table. We'd sit in the back. We'd get three or four cups of coffee during the body of the meeting. I see we've got some people doing that kind of stuff now. But we'd get three or four cups of coffee during the meeting. We were a complete and utter disruption. We would find men who thought adolescent newcomers were cute. I know who you are. We'd write notes. We'd get dates. You know, we were just absolutely all about anything other than learning how to stay sober. And we did that for, you know, several weeks. And we would always get there 15 minutes early, bum cigarettes outside, be late, make noise, screech chairs, get multiple cups of coffee, and we would dash out the door right as people were circling up for the Lord's Prayer. Because I wasn't all that interested in praying, and I didn't know the words to the Lord's Prayer. And I wasn't going to let you know that I didn't know the words to the Lord's Prayer. You weren't going to pull my punk card like that. And so we would slip out so that nobody would know that I didn't know what I didn't know. And we would do that day in and day out. And I kept working on my sister. Let's go drink. Let's go drink. Let's go drink. And she would say, no, no, no. And I'm thinking, you're not getting anything out of this deal anyway. But, you know, she's getting dates. You know, there's things happening for us. And we went to dash out of a meeting. I was in front of my sister. She got caught in the back of the room. And I was dashing out the meeting before the Lord's Prayer one night. And there was this man in Alcoholics Anonymous. His name was Max Shadburn. And he would sit toward the back of the room as well. So he got to overhear all of our shenanigans. He would sit toward the back of the room. He'd been sober since Christ was a child. He was old as dirt. He wore those reading glasses that sat down real low on his nose, so he was always looking over top of them. And I swear he had the longest finger because he was always wagging it at people, you know, telling people what they were doing wrong. And Mac, you know, Mac was that guy. I knew that if there was a president of Alcoholics, it was Mac because he seemed to be in charge of everything. You know, people would make a comment in a meeting and they would look to him for approval. You know, somebody would say, you know, what page something was on in the big book, and they looked to him to see if they were right. You know, and there was only one woman in the whole room who would argue with him, and she sat up front. And she was also sober since Christ was a child. And the two of them would fight. So, you know, I didn't know if it was, you know, she could be the queen. Who knows? I don't know how you people do this thing. And so I go to dash out of a meeting right before the Lord's Prayer, and Max steps in front of the door like this. He said, get in the circle. So I walked over and got in the circle and stood there and looked terrified because I was. And as soon as the circle was over, I headed back for the door, and Mac was still standing there, and he looked at me and he said, are you an alcoholic? Well, I don't know. I mean, I was diagnosed with alcoholism. I'd answered questionnaires and that called me an alcoholic. People had been telling me, labeling me that I was alcoholic, but nobody ever asked. And I said, I don't know. He said, can you control your drinking? When you start drinking, can you stop? And I said, I mean, I just took the top off the bottle and threw the top away. Stopping, I mean, who stops? I mean, seriously. And I said, I don't know. He said, well, here's $5. Go find out. He said, if it doesn't work, you get back here. But if it does, I never want to see you again. So I went and I got my sister and I'm like, go get your $5. We are out of here. So I'd been working on her from the outside. The disease had been working on her from the inside. Max Shadburn gave us $10 collectively. And my sister and I, we relapsed. March 14th, 1987, she and I hit it again. And what I can tell you is that I was searching for that feeling of relief. I was searching for that release from care, that release from my head, that release from everything that I was thinking and feeling and the craziness. I was looking for that again. I was looking for my fists to let loose and for my shoulders to come down from my ears, and I didn't know if it was going to ever be possible again. But what I also wanted to do was I wanted to control my drinking. I figured 3 shots and 2 beers was moderate drinking. And so I went out that night and I said, I'm going to have 3 shots and 2 beers. I'm going to catch a little bit of a buzz. I'm going to get a little bit of that release. My shoulders are going to come off my ears. My hands are going to release. I'm going to be able to exhale and my head will stop. And that's my equation. And so I went out. I had 3 shots and 2 beers and I drank them really fast. You know how we drink fast because we want to get it started right now. And so I drank them really fast and then I sat there. Just waiting. I wanted to see if it was going to happen. I wanted to see if 3 shots and 2 beers was going to be enough. I wanted to be able to control my drinking. I wanted to be able to stop right there and ride it out. I wanted to be able to not go to Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. I wanted to get my head shut down, but I didn't want to drink so much that I ended up over there again. And I had 3 shots and 2 beers and I waited, and it came. It wasn't as much relief as I wanted. My shoulders didn't come all the way down, but they came some of the way down. I exhaled about halfway. You know, and 3 shots and 2 beers is a lot of alcohol when you haven't had anything to drink for a couple of months. So it was working. And then the thought hit me. Well, I'm almost there. It's possible that I just undershot my mark a little. I mean, just a little. Maybe if I just have one more shot. You know, just one more. I don't want to go to oblivion. I don't want to do that. I just want to get a little bit more relief than I've got right here. And so I had one more shot. Now, shot, you understand, I'm not using glasses. It's just taking the tug out of the neck of the bottle. And so I have one more, and I sit there, and it rolls on me, and I think, it's better. But I don't know if it's as good as it could be. And so I thought, you know, maybe just a little beer. I would just chase it down. I don't need another shot. And it was another shot and another beer and another shot and another beer, and guess where I went? I crossed the tracks. It was amazing to me that I absolutely needed to drink more and more and more. And it came on me the very first night that I went out drinking again. And you know, I drank myself into oblivion that night. You know, bad things happened yet again. I wasn't able to keep myself safe. I wasn't able to stay where I wanted to stay. I wasn't able to control my drinking. And I came to the next morning, and the thought that I had was, I am really young and I'm healthy. I could live like this for a really long time. I could cross those tracks every day for a really long time. And I could have this stuff happen to me for a really long time. And I had had just a little bit of time where I wasn't drinking and I wasn't crossing the tracks. And some things do get better just by not drinking. And I thought, I can't do this for a lifetime. I cannot do this for a lifetime. And I remembered what Max Shadburn said. He said, if it works, I never want to see you again. If it doesn't, you get back here. And I walked back into Alcoholics Anonymous that night, March 15th, 1987, and you haven't been able to get rid of me since. What I wanted was to not have to drink like that anymore. I had absolutely no interest in working steps. I had no interest in getting a God of my own understanding. I had no interest in necessarily being kind to you people. I had really no interest in getting there on time, sitting in the front, and being a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just wanted to do whatever it was going to take for me to not drink anymore and to stop my head. That's all I was after. If you would have asked me what I wanted when I grew up, I would have told you I wanted to be skinny and ride a big Harley. I mean, that's really all I wanted. You know, I had absolutely, well, I had limited goals. And I had a limited understanding of what could be possible in my life. And I can tell you I'm standing here today, I ride a big Harley and skinny is relative. But I also have a God of my understanding. My head doesn't run in circles. I no longer live with shame and guilt and remorse. I no longer cross the street because you're coming down it and we're not square with one another. I no longer walk into a room and assume that everyone's not going to like me. I walk into a room and assume everybody's going to like me. Why wouldn't you? I mean, you may not love me, but I'm pretty nice, I'm pretty chatty, and I don't do anything to harm anyone, so why wouldn't you like me? You know, I walk around standing up straight with my shoulders back, and I look everybody that I meet in the eye. And there's absolutely nothing to be afraid of anymore. And I wasn't planning on getting all of that. All I wanted to do is not have to cross the tracks and not have to drink myself into oblivion. You see, I spent 40 days in treatment, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. I spent 40 days in treatment, and all they did was talk about the consequences of my drinking. I spent 40 days in treatment, and I didn't leave there with the knowledge that alcoholism was an illness and that it meant that I was allergic to it, that I was physically allergic to alcohol, and that I had a mental obsession that would not stop. I didn't know that my head was set to try to convince me every single day that drinking was my best option, and a body that was set to not let me stop when I wanted to stop. I didn't know that those two things were true for me. What I knew was that when I drank way too much. I went to bad places and bad things happened. And when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous and I listened to the stories of the people around me, they were talking about things like drinking away families and neglecting children and getting DUIs and going to prison and having all of these external consequences. And, you know, their probation officer was the only person who would talk to them. I mean, all of these external consequences were going on in these people's lives, and I couldn't relate to any of it. I could not relate to any of it. And every now and then there would be somebody in that room and they would talk about the fact that when they put alcohol in their system, there was something, it was like flipping a switch and they just required more. Now that I could relate to. And they talked about the fact that, you know, that their head would tell them that it was okay to take a drink, whether they were happy or sad or somewhere in between, that their head was always trying to convince them to take a drink. And that I could relate to. You know, drinking for 30 years and drinking away careers and doing all of the stuff that so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous have lived through, I couldn't relate to that stuff. But I could relate to the fact that every single time I put alcohol in my system, I needed to have more. That was just my truth. And you know what? The truth is the truth, whether I believe it or not. So what happened was this. I went back to a meeting on March 15th, 1987, and I got there on time. I bummed a cigarette, but I finished it on time. I went down. I didn't screech my chair. I sat in the middle, not in the front. And I got one cup of coffee, and I stayed seated through the entire meeting. And when the Lord's Prayer came, I stood in the circle. And luckily, if you guys remember, not all of you will remember the late 80s, but some of you will. In the late 80s, we had really big hair. I mean, you think I have a lot of hair now, you ought to see it when I tease it and try to make it big. And we had a lot of big hair, and we would hairspray it in place, and there would be hinges right here. And so if you would lean your head forward, all of your hair would come down, and it would completely cover your face. And so I would stand in the circle for the Lord's Prayer, and I would lean my head down so that my hair would hinge forward, and you didn't have to know that I didn't know the words because you couldn't see my face. And that was key. And I went to leave that meeting that night, and guess who was standing at the door? Max Shadburn was standing at the door like this again, and he said, "Did you get a sponsor?" I said, "No." And he said, "You get a sponsor before you leave here." And I thought, So I turned around and I, you know, started with the sickest women I knew and worked to health. And I just walked up to them and I said, "My name's Deb, I'm back. Will you sponsor me?" And all of them said, "No. No. No. None of them said, "No, I can't. I sponsor too many. No, I can't. I have a new job. No, I can't. I have a new baby. No, I can't." You know, all of the reasons that we give other alcoholics for not wanting to work with them. They didn't offer any reasons or any excuses to get out of service work. All they said was no. And so I go to leave the room, and Mac is still standing at the door, and he said, "Did you get a sponsor?" And I said, "No one will sponsor me." And he said, "That's a lie." And I said, "I'm not asking her." And he said, "Oh, yes, you are." And I said, "Uh-uh." And he said, "Mm-hmm." So I walked over to Jane. Jane was the queen of Alcoholics Anonymous who sat in the front. Jane was 73 years old. She'd been sober longer than I'd been alive. When the car would pull up with Jane for the meeting to the back door of the church, newcomers would scurry about, grab her high-backed, stiff chair, take it out car side, help her into it, and then they would carry her into the meeting like the Pope rolling through the piazza. They would sit her in her front slot. She would get the only crystal ashtray in the room when the rest of us are using those metal deals that wiggle and the bottoms, you know, and they get bowed. And she would smoke cigarettes on an extender. And she was the gal who knew what page every freaking sentence in the big book was on. And she would argue with you if you were untoward in any way in that meeting. And everybody was respectfully terrified of Jane. And I was like, oh. But I walked up to Jane and I said, "I'm back. Will you sponsor me?" And she looked up at me and she, you know, she wore her hair back in one of those buns. You know, she was 73 and had this light that shone around her. And she took a drag off that extender off the cigarette and she said, "Why should I?" Now, I had something to say about that because I was 15 and I had something to say about everything. And my vocabulary wasn't very expansive. And I was going to tell her where to shove cigarette extender and her program of Alcoholics Anonymous and that freaking God you people talk about. And so I had something to say. And, you know, God, my entire life, and he still does it today, I will open my mouth to say something and what comes out was absolutely not intended. It just, you know, he does that. He heads things off for me today. And so I opened my mouth, and instead of telling her where to shove her cigarette extender, I said, "Because I need to be sober, and I don't know how." And she said, "Well, there are some things that you're going to be doing." And she gave me the list. And some of you have gotten the list from the first sponsor. It's how often you're going to call, how many meetings you're going to go to, what pages you're going to read on what days, you know, all of that stuff. So she gives me the list. And of course, I wanted to tell her where to put her list. And instead, I said, "Yes, ma'am." Now, I was raised in Ohio. We weren't raised with manners. So, call her ma'am, I mean, I have no idea where that came from. But I said, "Yes, ma'am," and I took my list. And this is what happened. Every single night at 7 o'clock, there is an enormous old car that wheels its way into my driveway. And I'm talking about these old Ford LTDs that float down the road. And you got to start turning them about half a block back because they think first about maybe making that turn, you know. And so there would just be this enormous boat of a car that would float its way into my driveway every night at 7 o'clock. And then they would stop it. And it was the kind of car that went like this and then it settled. And in it would be two old men smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, listening to country music, and laughing at their own jokes. And I'm like, I mean, these guys roll into my driveway, and I'm like, "What is this?" And my mom, she goes, "Honey, AA is here." And I'm like, my life is over. And they would sit there and they would wait on me to get in the car. And they wouldn't get out and argue with me. There was no conversation. They would sit there for as long as it took for me to just get in the car. And you know, there were days, particularly in those first weeks, where I would stand on my front porch, and the head of a newcomer is a scary place. We all know that. But I would stand on my front porch and I would just stare at them and I would think, I'm not getting in the car. I don't know them. It's a new car. They're new people. They could be dangerous. I'm not getting in that car. I don't want to go to a meeting. I went to a meeting yesterday, the day before that, and I don't understand what they're talking about in those meetings anyway. They have a language that I don't understand, and they're all freaking happy, and I'm not happy, and I don't want to listen to their jokes because all their jokes are stupid. And they're not going to bring me home. They're going to make me go to the freaking donut shop, and I don't want to go to the donut shop. I don't even want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Who said that this was a good idea anyway? And I would stand there, and I would have this conversation with myself in my head. And then I'd get in the freaking car. And they were there every single night. I mean, Saturdays, Sundays, they were there every single night. And one night I thought I was going to be slick. And because I knew on Monday nights, they were going to try to take me to the Barberton meeting. All of the meetings up there were speaker meetings. And they were going to take me to the Barberton meeting. It started at 8, and it was going to take us 30 minutes to get there. And these guys were never late for anything. They were always early, which was also terribly annoying because what are you going to I didn't have anything to talk to them about at the donut shop. How in the world am I supposed to talk to them before there? So I'm standing on my porch and I think, if I stand here until 7:35, now that's 35 minutes. If I'm here for 35 minutes, they will leave because there won't be time to get to the meeting and they're not going to go late. And so don't tell me alcoholics don't have willpower. I stand on my front porch for 35 minutes, and I'm looking at them, and they could care less. They're smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, listening to country music, and telling the same bad jokes. And they're fine just sitting right there. And at 7:35, I walk up to the window, and I said, well, fellas, looks like we'd be a little late for that meeting tonight. Just going to have to take a night off. And they said, there's an 8:30 in Cleveland. Get in the car. So I got in the car. And every time a new car would pull in and with people in it that I didn't know, I'd walk up and I'd say, who are you? And they'd be like, Jane sent us. Get in the car. See, what I didn't know is that they'd had a group conscience meeting. And they decided that Mac was going to throw us out, and if we came back, Jane was going to sponsor us. But Jane was really old, and she was very sick. And she said, and she had told them that she didn't have the energy to sponsor us the way we would need sponsored, and so we were going to be a group project. She would direct them, and everybody did what Jane told them to do anyway. So I was sponsored by everybody I came into contact with in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was incredibly annoying. And she also said that nobody was allowed to let me talk in meetings because she said the meeting is where we talk about the solution. You have no idea what that is, and you'll not be spreading the disease. I had to finish working my steps before I was allowed to open my meeting my mouth in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so immediately I wanted to do my steps because that meant that I could talk. And, you know, it's all about me, and I had so much to say. And so I went to Jane, and I had been sober, 6 weeks. And I was like, you know, we need to get on these steps. It's my understanding if I don't work these steps, I'm going to drink again. Well, she was thoroughly unimpressed. And she said, you're not ready for the steps. And I said, what are you talking about? She said, you go figure out what the four absolutes are. Once you figure those out, then you can work the steps. Now, in the Akron area, we still had the four absolutes, and they were still on the placards. I know that there was a workshop on the four absolutes here. And the four absolutes are absolute love, honesty, purity, and unselfishness. And she said, if I figured out what those things were, then she would allow me to start working the steps. And so I started going to extra meetings. and started going to discussion meetings so that I could go ask the chairperson to bring up the topic of the four absolutes for me so that maybe I could figure out what they were. One day I sat down with my dictionary. I tried this first, and I looked up the definition for love, honesty, purity, and unselfishness. And I took them to Jane, and I said, here's what they are. And I read her the definitions, and she said, I don't want what the dictionary says. Keep looking. And so I brought it up. I had chair people bring it up in meetings, and everybody, you know, we never really talk very clearly in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we talk in circles, and we give our take on things and all that kind of. And so that wasn't really helpful, but I was going to extra meetings to try to figure out what the four absolutes were, and I was just getting nowhere, and I'd been working at it for a couple of weeks, and Mac Shadburn, who had not spoken to me since the night he made me get a sponsor because he had a resentment, he came up to me and he said, I hear that you're looking for the definition of the four absolutes. And I said, yes, sir. I said, I can't move on with my step work until I figure out what these things are. And he said, all right, here's the deal. The four absolutes, he said, those are the goals of recovery. Those are the principles you're going to apply to your life. He said, and if you can get a little bit more honest, have a little bit purer motive, and love a little bit more, and be a little bit, he said, you'll be moving forward in your recovery. He said, they're the goals. He said, that's what we work for in here. And I said, okay, great, thanks. He said, but don't tell Jane I told you. So the next time I saw Jane, I was like, Jane, the four absolutes, those are the goals of recovery. I'm going to be moving toward those things in my step work. And she said, that damn Mac, I knew he'd tell you. Oh. So at that point, she launched me on a vigorous course of action. Everything she asked me to do came out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, all of the instructions are in there. All the instructions are followed by promises. You know, I didn't know that it was as time-tested and as true as it was. I just knew that I was doing what I was told. I didn't know that the first 164 pages plus the doctor's opinion is the text of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea. All I knew is that when I was told to read page 10 through 12, I better read page 10 through 12. One time she stuffed a $5 bill right in the middle of the pages that I was supposed to read, and I went to meet her to tell her what I had gotten out of what I read. I was just going to talk in circles and put a lot of BS out there. She took my book, opened it up, and handed me that $5, and she said, you didn't read that. You'd have spent that money had you read it. So I was busted, and you know, but she... She absolutely launched me on a vigorous course of action. And you know, it was sitting in that donut shop after meetings that I came to understand that I had an allergy to alcohol. It was sitting in that donut shop after the meeting that I started to get an understanding of what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was. You know, I listened to those old guys talk about how their lives came back together. I listened to them talk about doing the inventory process and figuring out exactly what was wrong with them and how they rectified that situation and how they made those amends. You know, I listened to those guys who were being invited to family dinner again, and they hadn't been invited to family dinner for 20 years. And they got to be there when their grandchild was born. And they hadn't even gotten to meet their other grandchildren until they were teenagers. But they were there when this next one was born. I mean, I got to listen to all of these stories. And they would tell me what they were like. You know, and they were a lot like my dad. And I was able to ask them. I said, you know, I said, I don't think that my dad loves me. And they're the guys that said, you know what? If he had the ability to love, he would love you dearly. But alcohol takes that from us. And so they gave me just a little bit of an open door to start to look at him differently. And these guys, they just absolutely put up with me and loved me. And I was allowed to ask as many questions as I wanted at the donut shop after the meeting. And so when you guys would go about and you would use that language I didn't understand, I would take all those questions to the donut shop and they would answer those questions for me. And when it came to this God stuff, now I didn't know until about 6 months ago where my bias against religion came from, because I wasn't raised in church. I wasn't really given any idea of God in my home at all when I was growing up, but for some reason I hated church folks and I hated churches, and I thought that that was a place I was never going to go. And we would sit at the donut shop and we would talk about God and we would talk about building a personal relationship with God, and they would talk about how they did it outside the church and that it didn't involve the church. And I could choose a concept of God that I could get my head around. And so what we did is we put together a concept of God. You know, one of them handed me a piece of paper one night over a donut and said, if you could have a God who was anything, what would he look like? What would he be? And so I wrote down a list of adjectives and I said, you know what? He would love me. He would forgive me. He would have a plan for me. He would be there for me. And I gave him the piece of paper, and he handed me the piece of paper back, and he said, this is your concept of God. Start there. You know, and it was just this really, really simple stuff that they all gave me. And they talked about starting from nothing, and now these guys, as far as I was concerned, were spiritual giants. They didn't do anything without consulting God. And so we're putting all of this stuff together. And I'm starting to get a God of my understanding. And I'm doing it outside of church. And so for 17 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I'm participating in this spiritual awakening and this spiritual rebirth. And I can stand here and tell you that over 22 years of being here and praying and seeking a relationship with God, once it became about not drinking and it became about living, it was all about my relationship with God. And my relationship with God has waxed and waned over the years. My prayer life in the last 5 years, it has become absolutely phenomenal. You know, I didn't even know how to pray. I started with the prayers that were in the big book, and then slowly I branched out from there. And I'm sitting with my sponsor in Akron over the holidays, and my husband and I are sitting there, and we're having breakfast. And my sponsor, she looked at me because we were talking about this God thing, and she said, you weren't raised in church. And I said, no. And she said, then where did your hatred for church come from? And out of nowhere, I remembered that when I was 7 and 8 years old, there was a church up the street from my house, and they had a big parking lot. And I would go up there and I would roller skate. And all of the neighborhood kids who had roller skates or skateboards or something, we would all meet there and we would roller skate. And on Wednesday nights, little roller disco fan back there. And on Wednesday nights, they would open the church doors, and a gal came out of that church, and she said, why don't you guys come in? We're having cookies and punch and doing some crafts. And at, you know, 7 or 8 years old, I thought that sounded like a good idea. So on Wednesday nights, we would go into the basement of this church, and we would eat cookies and drink punch and do some kind of craft. And we did this for a long time. And what I didn't know was that at 8 years old, I believed that they should have known that something was wrong. I believed that they should have known that I was as hurt as I was and that I was as scared as I was and that they should have come home with me and fixed it because I just lived down the street. I believed that if they were really in tune with God, that God would have told them to come and save me. And I didn't know that I had those thoughts until this past holidays when I was sitting there talking with my sponsor and my husband. And we all kind of sat back and went, who knew? I had no idea that that's where that stuff came from. But what I can tell you is that in working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as they're outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it led me to a God of my understanding and to a relationship with Him that is absolutely outstanding. I mean, today I take everything to God in prayer, just like those old guys did, and I thought that they were silly, and I thought that they were weak. And when I go to God in prayer today, I get answers. And I get answers because I hang out with people like you in rooms like this and I listen to what you have to say because God works through you to tell me what I need to know. You know, about 6 years ago, I had spent my entire recovery dating who I wanted, you know, getting in and out of relationships. I was married and divorced in recovery, you know, went for the head fake. I'd kind of always run that part of my life. I always ran that part of my life. And so I was busy doing that. About 6 years ago, I met this guy, and he was, you know, 6'1" and had broad shoulders and a bald head. And he was at that time a captain in the Marine Corps, and he had blue eyes, and he was really nice, and he was all these things. And so we started dating each other. We rode Harleys together. We golfed together. And slowly, over the course of a couple of years, I committed to being in this relationship with him. And so we were doing this thing, and I was and God was in the middle of doing a spiritual rearrangement on me. And I was getting really, really uncomfortable. And I was speaking at the Louisiana State Convention just before the storm. And we were staying in the Landmark Hotel. For the Louisiana State that year. And it was on Easter weekend. And I was in the middle of this spiritual rearrangement, and it became really, really clear to me that I was no longer allowed to choose my own boyfriends and my own mates because clearly I wasn't doing that great of a job with it. But I had been in a relationship with this guy for a couple of years and I just adored him. I mean, we were best friends and I just loved him. But God told me that weekend under a series of all kinds of circumstances, and he basically said, you have abandoned yourself to me, but only so far. I want the rest. And I knew exactly what he was talking about because that's the one area of my life that I would never give him. I thought that he was going to, I don't know, hook me up with somebody ugly. And so I had held out. And God said very clearly to me that weekend, you know, it's over. I want all of you. I have perfect love to give you, but you've got to do your part. You have to abandon yourself to me. And I knew that that meant that I was going to have to follow through on this thing. You know, I had been called, I had been pushed and pulled and encouraged to go ahead and to join a faith group and to be baptized and to do this thing. For a long time, I was 16 or 17 years sober at the time, and I had just been saying, I hear you, God, but not yet. I hear spiritual arrogance, I'm all about it. I hear you, God, but not yet. Just give me a little bit more time. And that weekend, he was like, time's up now. And so I went home and I broke up with that beautiful man who I love so much. And he sat there and he listened to me and he said, you're leaving me for God? And I said, yes. And he said, are you sure there's not another guy? And I said, no, there's not. He said, you're leaving me for God. And I said, I have to. I cannot any longer be in a relationship with someone who doesn't love God. I have to have a prayer partner. I have to have somebody who lives the way I live and who loves God the way I love God. It doesn't mean that we're going to do everything perfect. You see, I always believed that as long as I was sober, I was the one who was going to have to, you know, it was between me and God. You know, I needed God to be sober. What you did, that was up to you. You know, like your spiritual life was none of my business. As long as I did what I needed to do, I was good. And God was saying, that's no longer enough. And so I broke up with him and we were miserable. I mean, every time we saw each other, we both cried. And it's ugly to watch a big bald Marine cry. But we both cried. I mean, we were just miserable apart. And, you know, and he came to me one day and he said, so what brand is it? And I said, what brand is it? And he said, yeah. He said, you're going to, you know, go get baptized and stuff, right? And I said, I am. And he said, what brand is it? I said, well, I'm going to go join the Catholic Church. And he said, are you sure you can't be Baptist or something? And I said, you know, I'm being called to the Catholic Church. And he said, all right. He was raised a Baptist. He had just walked away from God and any kind of pursuit of a relationship with God years before that. And he said, so Catholic it is? And I said, yeah, Catholic it is. And he said, all right, what time do we go? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, he said, I've always loved God. He said, I just haven't been working on my relationship with him. He said, so if you're becoming Catholic, I'm going to go with you. Because I don't want to worship in a place other than my wife. And I said, your wife? And he said, yes, we're going to join the Catholic faith together and then we're going to get married. And it takes a long time to become Catholic. They put you through classes and stuff. And so we worked at becoming Catholic. We were completely dedicated to it. And on Easter in 2006, my husband and I were both, I was baptized and we were both brought into the Catholic faith and given all of our sacraments. And when I was doing an hour of prayer and meditation, it's called adoration, just before that. And he had shown up and I was on my knees and I was praying and I felt that someone was next to me and I kind of looked, I opened my eyes a little bit and my husband was on his knee and he had an engagement ring and he put it on my finger and we joined the Catholic faith. We put things in the right order for the first time in my life. I put things in the right order and then we were married. So we were married in June of 2006. We'd been together for just over 3 years at that point. And we were married in June, and he left for Iraq in September, or in August. He was gone for about a year, and he got back in August. I moved out to the desert in California where I currently live. He got back from Iraq. He was home for a couple of months, and they moved the deployment up again, and they turned around and they went back to Afghanistan. And so he was deployed a lot. And while they were deployed, they lost 100 men from the field of battle due to significant life-changing injury. I mean, the Taliban were absolutely ripping them apart. And they were getting more of them than they were getting of us, but we were taking some serious casualties. And they were launching mortars into the CP where my husband worked. And things were really bad. And you know, he would send me emails, and sometimes I opened an email one day and he said, "Another IED, honey, nothing left but a boot. Pray for us." And so I prayed. And I prayed. And I talked about it at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I talked about it from podiums like this. And I told people in middle America through Alcoholics Anonymous what was going on over there, and people prayed. And they came home. And my husband came home. And I was never so grateful. I was never so grateful. He got home just before Thanksgiving last year. And he had seen things and done things. And he had seen things and he had done things over there that he never planned on seeing or doing. It was just really, really hard on him. And he and I, we worked together. We were a team in bringing him back all the way. You know, physically he was back, and mentally and emotionally it took him some time. And we worked really hard at it, and we were, you know, we finally started firing on all cylinders after he'd been home for about 6 or 8 weeks. And, you know, at one point we were arguing about something really stupid, you know, and I looked at him and I said, "Honey, we're Catholic. You're not allowed to divorce me." And he threw up his hands and he goes, "Ugh, the Catholic thing again." You know, and from that moment on, we were good again. And we just worked so hard at putting everything back together. And I learned more about the application of faith, not the acquiring of faith, but the application of faith while he was deployed. I learned what it was about to be faithful and faithful to a relationship with God and trusting that there was going to be a plan out there for me and trusting that he was going to do everything in his power to bring my husband home safe, and he did all of that. And 25 days ago, my husband was killed on his way home from work in a motorcycle accident. And we had finally had it all together. We were having fun again. We were communicating. We were praying together. We would get up in the morning. We would get up early. And I wake up ridiculously happy. I mean, it's annoying. And I would wake up ridiculously happy, and I would go out in the kitchen with my toothbrush in my mouth, and I would dance until he would smile and dance with me. And he was a horrible dancer. I saw a guy over here, I think in a Washington Redskins jersey. That's you. He was doing the wounded boxer. And my husband, he would resist every morning, and then he would finally give in and he'd do the wounded boxer, and then he'd kiss me on the forehead and send me into the shower, and I'd get out of the shower and I'd come out and he would have oatmeal ready for us. And we would sit down and we would read the daily readings, the scriptures together, and we would try to figure out what the spiritual principles were in there so we could try to apply them to our life. And then we would say a prayer together, and then we would both leave and we'd go to work. And that's what we did every morning for the last several months. And we were just insanely happy. And then, you know, on Tuesday the 28th, you know, I was leaving my work at 8:15, and I work out on the same military base where my husband was stationed. I called him about 8:15. It had been a really long day. And I said, I'm headed home. You know, when are you coming home? Because he never came home early. He always had too much work to do. And he said, "I have a few things. I'll be right behind you." And I said, "So that means what, about 10:30? And he just laughed and he said, "Yeah, baby, probably 10:30. And so I went home and I ate and I went to bed and I woke up about 10 o'clock. You know, I'd just been asleep maybe 15 minutes and I just kind of startled awake and I was standing in my kitchen and I knew something wasn't right. And I'm staring out my kitchen window, which looks down on the town with all of the lights, and there were some odd lights down there. And I was just standing there staring and I thought, I wonder where he is. And I thought, well, that's just silly. He's just running late. He always runs late. So I called his cell phones and he wasn't answering. And I said, well, he's not answering because he's on his motorcycle. He can't answer his phone while he's on his motorcycle. So I figured I'm going to give him 45 minutes. And if he's not home in 45 minutes, then I'll worry. So I relaxed and I had a glass of water and I sat down and I waited for 45 minutes. And it was a little after 11 and he still wasn't home and he still wasn't answering his cell phones. And I picked up the phone and I called the officer of the day for the battalion and I said, this is Deb Helton. I never do this, but is Major Helton anywhere around there? And he said, hold on, ma'am. And he put Captain Shellhaus on the phone and he said, Deb, this is Ross. And he never, ever uses his first name. And I said, Ross, what's going on? And he said, I'm so sorry, but Lee was killed about 10 o'clock. In a motorcycle accident. And I said, Ross, are those the lights I see out my kitchen window? And he said, ma'am, he was killed in front of the coffee, and he told me the name of the coffee shop. And I said, those are the lights I see out my kitchen window. I was staring at my husband's accident scene. And he said, can you stay right there? We're going to be right over. And you know, whenever my husband was deployed, for the first couple of weeks that he was deployed, I would wonder, you know, we have these morbid thoughts when these kinds of things happen, and I would wonder, you know, if he gets killed in combat, I wonder who my guy is going to be. You know, it's the guy who puts on the dress blues and comes and knocks on your door and tells you that your husband's been killed. And I thought, I wonder what my guy's going to look like. And then it just takes me a couple of days and I work through that and I pray a lot and I let it go and I live my life and it, you know, and I do the deployment and it's fine and he comes home. And I'm standing in my kitchen and I've been told that my husband's dead and Ross says, stay right there, we'll be right over. And the battalion commanding officer, my husband's the executive officer, the battalion commanding officer, he comes walking in. And I told Ross on the phone, I said, don't let him put on his dress blues. Don't let him do that. He said, okay. And Lieutenant Colonel Reed, his name is John. John comes walking in my door. And I looked at him and I said, so you're my guy? He said, I'm so sorry. And I said, I don't want you to be my guy. He said, I don't want to be your guy. But I'm here. And about 5:30 in the morning, we were sitting up drinking coffee, staring at the wall. And we were sitting out on my front patio, and I had sent out some text messages to some people, to some AA people, to some of you. I'd sent out some text messages and said, call me the moment you wake up. It's been a bad night. And people called, and I told them what happened, and I looked at John, and I said, John, you need to know something. And he said, what is that? And I said, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's going to be a really motley crew of people showing up here very shortly. And he said, I'm not sure what that means. And I said, you'll understand in a little while. But as soon as the sun comes up, they'll be here. You know, and by 7 a.m., my house was full. I had 12 AA people. They were cooking and cleaning and shopping and rearranging and making phone calls and making sure the coffee stayed fresh and hugging and crying and doing all of those things that we do for one another when we have to. And they were walking around, they were staring at each other and they were having whispered conversations about how this just isn't fair. And she just got him back. And I sat out there and I said, I can hear you and that's not helpful. And so they decided to walk around and pray instead. And so they walked around all day and they were just praying and doing things for me and anticipating my needs. And one of my AA friends is a travel agent. And so she's on the computer and she's making plane reservations for Lee's family and my family and just making things happen. And John's just sitting there watching all of this with a little smile on his face. And I said, are you okay? And he said, they're a motley looking group of people, but they sure love you. And I said, yes, they do. And he said, you know, he said, my mother-in-law's in AA. He said, well, my mother-in-law's sober. She doesn't really go to AA. And I said, that's too bad. And he said, it is, because she's missing out on this. And I said, yes, she is. And you know, 25 days, guys, I wish I could stand here and tell you that I've been a, you know, spiritual giant and knew all the answers and knew what I was supposed to do next. And what I can do is I can tell you this. I know it's not God's fault that my husband died. You know, I had a buddy over at one of the old timers in my group. He came over the other day and he said, you know, he said, it's okay to be angry with God. And I said, why would I be angry with my best friend? Why would I believe for a moment that God had anything to do with this? You know, a buddy of mine, Walter Hall from Houston, Texas, he's one of my spiritual giants. He called me right away and he said, sweetie, he said, there are things that happen in this world that break God's heart. And this, I believe, is one of them. So you just need to know that God's heart is mending along with yours and you're not alone in this. And, you know, people have asked me, I mean, I talked to my buddy Billy shortly after it happened because I had a speaking engagement coming up and I didn't know what to do. And Billy said, you know what, I'm speaking down the road about an hour from where you're supposed to speak. He said, if you need me, I'm speaking Friday night and I was in the Saturday slot. He said, if you need me, you call me and I'll drive up at no additional cost to the committee and I'll speak in your slot if you just can't do it. And that gave me the freedom because there was a backup to go ahead and go and see if I could do it. And Sally gave me the same freedom coming here. She said, just come and be with us. And if for some reason there's that wave of grief that's over you and you can't speak, just say the word and we have people who can stand in your place. And all I know to do right now, guys, is to pray a lot and keep my commitments. That's all I know how to do. I know that that's right. Everything else is a bit of a crapshoot. My whole life has changed. But the fact that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, in good standing, means that I get to be with you. And it means that I get to tell you what I need when I know. And I get to allow you to be of service to me. And you know what? I'm usually that girl. You know, I'm usually that girl. Your life blows up, you want me in your corner. You know, because I am the leader. You know, when the house fills up with people, I'm in there. Remember, I'm in charge of everything. And for the last 25 days, I've just had to do it this way. And I've just had to allow you guys to support me and love me. And to do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And to be of service to me. And thank you so much for showing up. And thank you for having me.